the organization I work for is University Health Network, and the hospital I work at is Toronto General Hospital. University Health Network stands for UHN, and it's comprised of a few different healthcare facilities. Mm-hmm. So Toronto Western Hospital, Princess Margaret, Toronto Rehab, Missioner Institute, and then Toronto General. So I work at one of the acute care sites. So currently I work as a registered nurse in the medical surgical intensive care unit. I'm also part of a critical care rapid response team, or critical care resource team. That's like a consulting service for the rest of the hospital to consult critical care support when patients are not doing well. And I'm also in school. I go to the University of Toronto for my second master's degree. This program is for a nurse practitioner training to reach people in Northern Ontario, particularly the community I grew up in Mattawa, and also in North Bay where I worked and went to school, just so they understand the gravity of the situation with COVID and the virus. I understand the lockdown is hard for everybody, and I empathize, and I can especially empathize in the sense that, you know, the cases are not the same in Southern Ontario as they are in Northern Ontario. However, the thing is with COVID is that you want to prevent it from getting out of hand, and that's a message I would really like to emphasize. And now I see in the media that to offload critical care hospitals here in Toronto, they are sending COVID patients to places like Sudbury and North Bay to help lighten the load. And I mean, there's nothing to, as a frontline registered nurse or healthcare worker, any healthcare provider, respiratory therapist, physician, doesn't matter. There's necessarily nothing to fear as long as you're following proper PPE protocol. However, it's also important to be, I feel, mindful that to make sure to always wear your PPE when you're working. And that I also follow the motto since last year from working in this is that there's no emergency in a pandemic. What I mean by that is when you need to attend to a patient, for example, that has COVID and there's risk of contracting the virus, you can't rush in there until you are properly donned with all your proper PPE. I really emphasize for people to recognize the seriousness of this virus, but also to be mindful that the key here is to prevent cases from happening or to prevent spread of the virus and to continue to follow proper PPE and to, you know, to adhere to public health guidelines, social distancing, washing your hands, using hand sanitizer, that sort of thing.
I think most people are cognizant of it. I'm not sure we're all guilty of being lax here and there. You're right. It's difficult when you're up north here and there's very low counts and you're used to a lot of freedoms and space and doesn't feel like it's dangerous.
Correct. Exactly. That's the tough spot, I believe, for people. And I can understand and I can empathize because I grew up there. I know I can see where they're coming from. There's not a lot of cases. It's really hard to actually visualize or believe it's actually happening. And to be honest, I feel that denial is a big strategy or coping, the result of people coping with this pandemic. So the denial is a common part of grief, actually. And it's almost like people don't believe it really is happening or the cases or... Oftentimes people ask me, like, do you really see COVID patients? Do you really take care of them? Is this for real? And I'm often expressing, you know, or share bits and pieces of cases about patients and families that I take care of. And yes, it's real, and it's very important to prevent it from spreading. And just to recognize this is short-term loss, if you will, for the betterment of the community's health. Because really, once the virus starts spreading, that's where you can run into issues.
Pardon me?
Once the virus starts to spread amongst the community and amongst people, that's where challenges, that's what causes more challenges, right? And that's when people really start to understand, okay, this is serious.
Almost too late then, though.
Yeah, but you don't want to follow that. Like, you don't want to follow that, oh, well, if we had 10 cases or 20 or 30 cases, then I'll take it more serious, that type of attitude. Because really, then, by then, it's a little too late. Not necessarily, but the purpose of my message is that we can prevent it, and we can prevent it from getting there, right?
Mm-hmm. Are they seriously younger people involved?
I've treated patients, all adult patients, 18, 20, 22, 32, 39, 40 years old, all ages, any ages. COVID does not discriminate. I've seen entire families admitted into the hospital. I've been in situations where entire families have COVID, cases where somebody had passed out at home and was pronounced dead at the scene. My suspicion was that they passed out because of lack of oxygen, or a term we would say they had a hypoxemia. I've had cases where I've had pregnant mothers that have had COVID, young people that we have to lie flat down on their stomach to help with, if you will, their oxygenation status. I've seen cases where majority of the cases actually that I take care of right now are young people, late teens, early 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. In the first wave, you'd see a lot of older people, but now within the second and third wave, especially the third wave, we see a lot of younger people. They're being put on machines. We refer to it as ECMO. The best way for me to explain it to the general public is you can think of it as a lung bypass machine or a heart-lung bypass machine. This is the most advanced type of life support you can provide to somebody, especially a COVID patient. To work at an organization that provides these services is not common. Where I work at Toronto General Hospital, that's their specialty. But it's a very extensive and advanced form of life support that takes a specialized center to provide it. I have seen people get better with this support. However, this type of life support is the recovery process even after COVID, after you've been hospitalized in the intensive care unit, regardless if it was just you're on a ventilator or with a ventilator and ECMO support, it's long. There's a long recovery process after that to get back to your baseline cognitive and physical function.
How many patients have been put on that type of treatment in the last month in your hospital? Can you guess?
I think there's almost 30 right now, if I had to speculate. These machines, I was informed that we had to be prepared to take care of patients, up to 30 patients on these machines. You have to have, a specialized center service. It's also an extra added nursing skill to be able to provide care with that are on ECMO. So we're trying, the organization is also trying to train nurses, fairly new nurses, quickly on this, for this type of support. And it's a skill set that you need to have quite a bit of experience as a nurse in general to fully grasp all the different intricacies that come with it. Because you can put somebody on this type of support, but you have to be able to manage a patient as well, mm-hmm. and manage the support and everything else that comes with it.
Yeah, it must be a lot of complexity to it.
Yeah, it's a very intricate complexity for sure. There's a lot of medical interdisciplinary teams involved in this care. You have to be, you have to have really strong clinical acumen to identify early when something is not going well with the patient. The thing is, too, with these type of supports or this type of advanced life support is you have to watch your patient very closely because it can be very dangerous in a sense. If one of these cannulas, because that's what the term is used, this is just the name of the device, if you will, a cannula that we use that the surgeons put in. If it ever dislodges, it can be serious, very serious as well. So you have to be very quick to respond to these patients and be available to them within seconds. Yeah, I hope that helps.
So when you say up to 30 patients, and that would be over the course of the month or the last month? Daily?
It's really hard to predict how these patients do.
Yeah.
But put it this way, when you are in a hospital and then you're in an intensive care unit and you're put on a ventilator, and a ventilator's not helping you enough, and then you have to be put on your stomach to help oxygenate your lungs, that's very serious alone to have to prone patients. That's the medical term. We refer to it as proning.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that fails and you have to be put on a lung or heart-lung bypass machine, that's very serious. These patients tend to be in a degree of sustained hypoxemia, so a sustained lack of oxygen for a period of time. With COVID as a result, there's inflammation throughout the body. Now, they can get better from one perspective, but it's the recovery process. I have seen patients that have not gotten off it, and they're still on it, and it's been months. Some patients can't leave unless there's some patients that are completely dependent on it and they end up passing away. Some patients need lung transplant. So it's the big, long recovery process after. Some don't get better at all.
Yeah, that's kind of what you sort of hear and see in some of the reports, but unless you're right there, it's really hard to imagine.
Mm-hmm. And where I work too, we are a referring center for ECMO. So if they do end up getting off ECMO, which I have seen patients get off ECMO, they go back to the referring home hospital. So as far as how they do, I don't really know. They could, you know, all I know is that they got off ECMO and they went back to their home hospital.
Oh, okay.
I don't know how they do after. Yeah. But there's a lot of patients who have become dependent on it.
What kind of insight can you share about how this is happening, that people get this sick? Are we missing some type of treatment before they get sick enough to go to the hospital? Is there anything being talked about there?
What kind of insight can I provide about the virus?
How
do people get so sick from it?
Yeah, maybe share a little bit about that. But I guess what I was asking is are we missing some type of treatment before they get that sick? Or what can people do once they get sick?
I mean, the medical community for physicians and researchers, they have, I'm sure, been working night and day around COVID. And the research out there so far has been remarkable to have come up so soon. I think also people need to keep in mind when people talk about, you know, for example, the vaccine or the research around it, they say, how can this come up so fast? Something I think of is that the world has been presented with a virus that had spread so rapidly. So it actually provided a good environment for researchers to have the opportunity to carry out the needed work that they have. I feel from a medical sense, medical community, they're doing a great job. I can speak more to a nursing community.
Mm-hmm.
I think what happens, especially in the younger population, is that from my experience, even just as a registered nurse, is that younger patients can compensate longer and not realize just how unwell they are. They can be short of breath for quite some time and not realize that they're actually lacking oxygen. I think from a public health perspective, one idea is to have medical even to have nurses to check in on patients at home that have COVID and just go in and check their oxygenation status and just to see how they're doing. I mean, that's a whole other domain as far as public health and policy, even from a political standpoint. But I feel like if some patients were checked on sooner at home or checked in just to see how they're doing, or even the basic vital sign, or sent home with a sat probe so they can check their oxygenation status, I think that would make a difference in the sense they would know to receive treatment sooner than waiting until they pass out at home.
I have read that exact advice. People talking about that is one way to make sure they don't get too far into it before they do come to the hospital.
Yeah. Like, I've seen patients come in and their oxygenation status is in the 40s, the 30s, and they're young. And you think, is this real? Like, am I reading this correctly? But it's real because we use secondary data to confirm that. And based on their clinical presentation, it's very evident.
What is the normal or healthy oxygen number?
It depends if somebody has their past medical history, especially if they have a respiratory or cardiac history. However, if you're a young, healthy person, closer to 100%, 95 and 100%, you don't really, and you don't have any like severe medical issues. That's the thing though with COVID and what I'm seeing now is that, especially an example I can use for healthcare workers to understand is when I go in to get report from the nurse about a patient, usually I get report and the report is the patient's past medical history can be or is fairly long, especially considering the type of unit I work on, because I also work with the transplant population and the cardiac population as well. A lot of times these patients don't have any past medical history or no known diagnosed past medical history. So from that perspective, as a nurse, when you give report and they say no known past medical history, it kind of really takes you by surprise. So my message obviously is to not scare people. That's not what I'm trying to do, or I'm not trying to scare the northern communities that I grew up in and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's more or less just to share what I see. And I mean, down south is very different than northern Ontario, but this is my reality and this could be anyone's reality too, right? I feel I've also seen cases too where when it does hit somebody or hit a family, they say those things. They're like, I can't believe this is happening. Again, it goes back to like they denial. They almost have a hard time believing what they see or what they're being told.
How critical do you think it is that there is paid sick leave for these places where people are forced to go into work even if they don't feel well?
Oh, I think that's very important, and I believe it's been well versed by a lot of medical fellow medical friends of mine as well. I think paid sick leave would be very helpful, especially for multi-generation households, primary, you know, frontline workers in different areas of work, factories, grocery stores, just any type of position where they can't get paid time off to isolate. Mm-hmm. And that would be very helpful for sure.
Makes sense. Have you noticed the burnout within the healthcare, the workers?
Yes, I have. I can definitely sense it. I mean, burnout is, burnout can be just feeling powerless within your position and not having any control of your environment. I feel like that can be one sense, for example, when their vacation's canceled because they have to be working. I'm sure that's happening everywhere. That can contribute to that. But also, I feel more it's like, seeing traumatic situations or hearing about traumatic situations, the trauma, like the term they refer to it as vicarious trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it really touched me when I heard my colleagues telling me, I don't know how many nurses I was working with, but they told me that their kids are with their parents and they won't see their kids for 2 months. I mean, that really, I felt for them. I really just shined a light just to how, to the extent that some of these my colleagues will go to still come into work. they will send their kids to their parents or wherever so they can properly isolate, if you will, when they come home from work, or they'll go sleep in hotels, that sort of thing. So I think that's definitely gotten to them, and I feel the child care aspect, and if they're in school, if they're not in school, I think there's definitely an element to that. Not being able to see family and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I mean,
that's
I can definitely sense it for sure.
That's
yeah.
True sacrifice, I'd say.
Pardon?
That would be true sacrifice in my definition. When your job takes you away.
Yeah, they sacrifice a lot. Yeah, the nurses, especially the nurses I've seen, and a lot of physicians as well, or even a lot of respiratory therapists, like a lot of people I've just spoken to briefly, like they have sacrificed a lot to come in and go to work still. And that really took me back when I heard people were dropping their kids off elsewhere. That kind of caught me by surprise, and I was like, oh, wow, yeah, I guess you would have to if you have a family. I mean, I feel fortunate enough I'm not in that situation, or have been put in that situation, so.
That's a tough spot.
Yeah, and I see a lot of people going above and beyond, and I can see things how they get to them. I know there's sometimes I even see my colleagues, they just start crying, and I don't know why they're crying. They don't know why they're crying, they'll just start crying.